So let me first specify what I mean by S-duality. So what I have in mind is that you have some conformal field theory with a fixed line. Here's your fixed line. And you have two or more special points on this fixed line. In the simplest cases, these are going to be zero coupling limits of gauge theories. And so what we mean by it being a duality is that these points are easy in some sense. It's easy to describe them, and the rest of the fixed line is hard. So in other words, if you deform along the fixed line, you get from one easy thing to another easy thing by way of something complicated. So the very simple example of this, which hopefully you've seen before, is n equals 4 super Yang Mills, where I might have something like this. So this fixed line is parameterized by the complexified gauge coupling. And on one end, I have, for instance, maybe an SUN gauge theory, n equals 4 gauge theory. And at another point on the fixed line, I have an SUN Monzian gauge theory. And actually, of course, when I talk about this gauge theory, I have to specify additional data, but I'm not going to go into that whole story. But this is the general picture. So you have different weakly coupled theories, and they lie on the same fixed line. In the case of n equals 4 theories, there's a whole extra layer about electromagnetic duality, but that I'm not going to be able to generalize to n equals 1. So I'm not going to talk about that. All right. So here's a simple n equals 4 example. So let me just sketch what an n equals 1 example is going to look like in general. Instead of having some weakly coupled point on the fixed line, most of the time, the special points on the fixed line are actually interacting. Instead, what you have is something like a flow coming from a weakly coupled point, or maybe even a series of flows coming from the weakly coupled point. So this point is still special in some sense, but it's not weakly coupled anymore. So a simple example of this is just take this theory here, which in n equals 1 language is just SUN plus 3 adjoints with a superpotential. And now I'm just going to give a mass to one of the adjoints and integrate it out. Since I remove one adjoint, that's inconsistent with n equals 4, and it's inconsistent with n equals 2, so I get an n equals 1 theory. So let me just integrate out pi 3, and now I'm going to have a non-renormalizable superpotential like this. Is that actually large enough to see back there? Marginal. So basically, something like this. And this, of course, is some effective theory. But don't get too worried about that yet. I can draw what the flows look like for this theory. So in terms of the gauge coupling, and let me call this H, the superpotential coupling, what I'm going to have, if I turn off the superpotential coupling, this is asymptotically free, and I go to some infrared fixed point, which is interacting. If I look at that fixed point, and I look at the anomalous dimension of the superpotential, this becomes marginal. And in fact, it's exactly marginal for reasons that there's no conserved current to pair up with it.
Sorry, confused.
Yes?
So this, before the superpotential, it was just nibble force per mil? So
yes. Before putting in the mass.
Ah, okay, sorry.
Right, so it's a mass deformation.
You're already integrated away.
Yes, exactly. But because I put in a relevant operator, I triggered a flow, right? And this is the endpoint of that flow.
Yes.
Well, this actually isn't the endpoint of that flow. The endpoint of that flow is what happens when I deform out along a fixed line. Because at the endpoint of this flow with just the gauge coupling, I have an exactly marginal operator, which is this superpotential. So I can move out in this direction. And because this is all inherited from n equals 4, what I know is that if I go out far in this direction, I'll actually come back to myself. So that's an S-duality in an n equals 1 theory. I can also draw the rest of the flows here, although, of course, they're not going to be asymptotically free. So for instance, there are flows that do this. So they go near weak coupling. But because the superpotential is irrelevant, of course, they don't end anywhere on any field theory, or at least not something that you can tell from the low energy perspective. But they, if you just think about them as some effective field theory, they do end up on the fixed line. So instead of hitting this point here, they actually end up on the fixed line. So you can think about this kind of effective field theory as a shorthand for what you mean by the fixed line, which is really a series of flows and then an exactly marginal deformation. But also the effective field theory will also hit the fixed line. All right, so that's what I mean by an n equals 1 S-duality. In some cases, it's not very easy to check if you have one or not. Because in this case, the reason I know that I have one is because it was inherited from n equals 4, where I have lots of things I can check. But in the n equals 1 context, I can't really directly check that this is an S-duality because I can't compute unprotected quantities. There is another circumstance in a slightly different sort of theory where I can at least do one non-trivial check, which is in the case where I have these two special points, which I'm going to call cusps, because that's what they are in n equals 4.
Is it obvious that these lines exactly marginal?
This one?
Yes.
You would have to write down the conserved currents and the operators, right? You follow the procedure that Seiberg and all laid out, right? But it is true. You can check it.
They're saying that the U1 that rotated both phis was already broken by.
Yeah. So another way of thinking about it is that there's a combination of H and lambda, which is neutral under all the flavor symmetries, including the spurious ones. So that's an equivalent way of thinking about it. So whenever you have that, then unless you have something funny like an accidental symmetry or something, then you're going to have a fixed line otherwise. And indeed, all the examples that I'm going to be talking about have this feature, that there's some combination of couplings that's neutral under all the flavor symmetries. So if you want to check, you can go and find the combination. All right, so let's see, where was I? Yeah, so in general, these n equals 1 examples are not checkable, because I can't compute unprotected quantities, so I can't figure out that, you know, for instance, I couldn't say for sure whether I really come back to myself, because you know, I'm coming back to myself. I can only see that I move out along the fixed line. All the protected quantities don't change. So that's not very interesting. But there's a different circumstance where I have two different cusps here, and these are identifiably different. I can look at these points and see that they're not the same. But however, when I move out along the fixed line and I compute some protected quantity like a superconformal index, I can see that it matches between the two. So that's very non-trivial evidence for an S-duality in that case. So what I need is I need two different cusps. And this is not different enough here, for instance, because this relies on the global structure of the gauge group. It's subtle, and the superconformal index is not sensitive to that. There is an n equals 4 example which does have the right properties, leaving aside.
If you could follow a defect along the line.
Yeah, that would be pretty hard, but maybe. Maybe there's more sophisticated tools, but for what I'm talking about, it's not possible. you just change the gauge group, there's one example where the Lie algebra changes. As you go to the S group.
This operation of turning on the mask can be done directly in the index. Is that correct? I can't remember if this operation of turning on the mask can be done directly in the index of the situation of the floor by adjusting a fugacity.
Basically, you're breaking some symmetry, and so you remove some fugacity from the index. Yeah, you can do that in the index. You can, of course, you can't do the inverse. It's a lossy process, right? Because you're reducing the number of symmetries. Which is why, if you know the index out here, you don't know what happens here. Because here, there's some extra symmetries that appear. All right, so this is an n equals 4 example, which has the properties we're going to be looking for in n equals 1 examples, which is that these cusps are easy to tell apart. They have different gauge groups. So let me tell you a little bit about these cases in particular, because they also relate to D3 rings. Now I can use that this board, so let me go here. So you can get these gauge groups by taking K D3 brains plus some O3 Planck. And there's more than one kind of O3 plane, of course. There's a plus and a minus. That's going to give you the SP or SO. But even beyond that, there's more than one kind. And this was worked out by Witten. In a sense, you use what you know about S-duality to figure it out, but it goes both ways. And so there's really four kinds of O3 planes. And one way of describing how they're different is by looking at the ADS dual of these gauge theories. So that's ADS5 cross S5 mod Z2. That's because I have an O plane. So I have an identification. But this identification carries some extra minus 1 to the F left. So there's an extra twist in there. And so that means, for instance, the cohomology groups are changed. So if I want to think about the cohomology group for the 3-form, either of the 3-forms, it's got twisted coefficients. So for say H3, the right group, has twisted coefficients that accounts for the fact that under the involution, H picks up an extra minus sign. And this is important because this group turns out not to be 0. Turns out to be Z2. In other words, I can turn on some discrete flux in this background. And because this is a Z2 and not a Z, that's not actually going to turn on H. It is just going to turn on a flat connection, but a non-trivial connection for H. So this tells me there's exactly two of them. So that's what I'm going to plot here. This is trivial and non-trivial. And here's H, and here's the RR 3-form F. So the simplest case, if you're Witten, you would just guess it this way, is that because this theory is self-dual, and zero flux is also self-dual, the SO2K n equals 4 theory should live here. And then you could make some hand-waving argument about how the non-trivial B is going to give you an extra minus sign in some worldsheet amplitudes and change from SO to SP. I don't actually know how to check that explicitly, but it's true. So actually, I'll tell you the difference between these two in a minute, but these are both the SP gauge theory. And this is the one that's left over, SO2K plus 1. I didn't derive for you that these were the right choices of discrete flux for these theories, but you can see, for instance, that this is consistent with what we know about S-duality in N equals 4 gauge theories and in type 2B string theory. Because these two points here are related by string theory S-duality. Which is the same as the S-duality in the gauge theory. The gauge theory, you could say, inherits it from string theory.
You're going to tell us about the other point.
Yes, I will tell you about the other point, if that's what you're worried about. Yeah, so the subtlety here is that when you shift the axion, normally you think I shift the axion by 1 and I come back to myself. But in the presence of this O3 plus, that's not true. The O3 plus changes when you do that. So if I shift the axion by 1, I get an O3 plus tilde, is what Witten called it. On its own, there's no difference between this object and the O3 plus. But if I have two of them, I can compare, and there is a difference. But in terms of this gauge theory here, where I have only one O3 plane, the right way to think about this is that it just doubles the periodicity of the theta angle in the gauge theory. In other words, in order to, the theta angle in the string theory normalization comes back to itself when I shift tau to tau plus 2. And if you think about it, you can work out that that's the right, that comes out right with a normalization of the gauge coupling also. So in 2B notation, if you normalize according to what the 2B tau is, then for SP, the theta angle has a periodicity of 4 pi. So in a sense, in the gauge theory, it just looks like conventions. But it's the right way to make things work out. Any questions about this part? After this, I'm going to move on to the slides. Right. Well, I will keep going and stop me if you have questions. So how do I turn this thing on? That's the question. Is the power button here?
Sorry?
How do I turn the projector on?
It's already on.
Oh, there we go.
But you can go to presentation mode on the right, there are the presets.
So now that I've told you some review about n equals 4 gauge theories and a little bit about what we expect from n equals 1 S-duality, now I'm going to actually go and look for n equals 1 S-dualities. And so the simplest, in terms of looking at D3 brains, the simplest place to look is just in an orbifold. So you know, I had a simple story for n equals 4, and now I'm just going to orbifold that. So what's the easiest orbifold? Well, in my opinion, it's this one. This is just a simple universal action on the coordinates, and it preserves a lot of symmetry. And now I want to put in the same kind of orientifold as I had before. And I'm going to put D3 brains at this orientifold singularity and see what happens. Now, something already non-trivial happens, because if I blow up the singularity, instead of finding O3 planes, I'm actually going to find that there are O7 planes here. And consequently, there are also D7 brains, because I need that in order to cancel the tadpole. So there's a fixed number of D7 brains here as well as an O7 plane. And partly that's going to manifest itself in the gauge theory by non-zero beta functions. So there's already some interesting things that can happen here, because for instance, this on its own could have gauge unicondensation. There's interesting dynamics that could happen at low n. So it's a little different from n equals 4, but some of the S duality is going to turn out to be analogous. All right, so what is the gauge theory that you get? Well, this is just the C3 mod Z3 gauge theory. And these are the orientipoles, which you can kind of think about as folding up the quiver diagram. But if you don't like that, these were worked out in the 90s just by world sheet methods. So it's very easy to get them. And there's two different kinds of theories. Much like n equals 4, there's some SO theories, except now I have an extra gauge group, an SU. And there's some SP theories. And so here, for instance, are the global symmetries of the SO theory. There's some SU3 symmetry, and there's some R symmetry. Again, it's actually the same global symmetries as n equals 4, except at n equals 4, it's really an SU4. And here it's not. So you can compare these SO and SP theories. You could ask, can they be S dual to each other, like was true before? And the simplest thing you can do is you can match anomalies. And indeed, you find that there is a match. So they match, I should say SO here. For the SO theory, the rank has to be 3 greater than the SP theory. There's some weird relation here. But that actually just has to do with the fact that the D3 charges of the two S dual theories should be the same. And there's some extra contribution from the D7 brains that's causing this difference. And indeed, you can see that these equations match for that relation. Sorry, I started changing notation when I made this slide. But that's a pretty weak check. Later in the talk, I'll find examples where anomalies match, but they're not S dual. A much stronger check is to compute the superconformal index. And there's a lot more information in the index, but it still won't change under RG flow, and it won't change under deformation. So it's still a good check of the S duality. And so for instance, we can do it for one of these theories. I'm going to pick a particular n. And I'm going to compute the index. I'm not going to compute it exactly, because that's too hard. Instead, I have this fugacity here that's associated to the R symmetry, and I'm going to expand in that. And so I expand, and I generate lots and lots of terms, as many as my computer will bear. And then I find that they match. So as opposed to anomaly matching, this is a very non-trivial check that we have two S-dual theories. And you can do this for other values of n. You can't go any lower, because you're going to get a runaway if you go lower, but you can go higher. And actually, funny thing is that at least this theory is IR-free. So you can even solve the dynamics on this side. So presumably S duality says that one should be 2, but you can't tell. Or at least I don't know how to find that out. All right, let me just put in a small aside here. In principle, if I want to show that this is really S duality and not universality, I should prove to you that the two cusps that I'm talking about are not the same cusp. Fortunately, that's very easy to do. You can figure out the right order of turning things on in order to get to the cusp. So in the SO case, you first turn on the SU gauge group, and then you turn on the superpotential coupling. And then this gauge coupling becomes exactly marginal here. Before that, it was irrelevant. And something similar happens here, just with different gauge groups. So what that means is that, much like the n equals 4 case, at the cusp, some gauge coupling is going to 0. And so you're going to get a much bigger global symmetry there. And so you can just look at that different gauge coupling going to 0 and say these are obviously not the same.
Wait, which superpotential again?
It's this guy here. Again, it's quite similar to the n equals 4 superpotential.
Thanks.
Right, so this tells us that clearly these are not the same cusps, and so what we have is some very non-trivial evidence that they are on the same fixed line. So we have strong evidence for S duality in this example. And I can also tell you what this means in the ADS dual. I can relate it to this discrete torsion that I was talking about, which is always a very useful thing to do because it gives you some predictions for what theory should be dual. Again, the tricky thing is that you don't know exactly how to line up the discrete torsion with the theories, but there's a consistent choice, which is very closely analogous to what was true for N before. So again, the two theories that are S dual to each other are here. The relation between the ranks means that for SO, this N had to be odd, and so there's one guy left over, which should be self-dual. And the story about the theta angle here is the same as before. So this, all of this is very similar to N equals 4.
So is the fourth point also self-dual?
Right.
What happens to it?
So this point?
Yeah.
Under this transformation, it's self-dual. But there's a whole SL2Z. So actually, every point here is self-dual under a congruent subgroup of SL2Zs. This is self-dual under SL2Z, and this is each of these points is self-dual under gamma 0, 2, or something that's congruent to it. So there's a lot of self-dualities, too. But again, the self-dualities are the ones that we cannot easily check for N equals 1 theories. At least it's not obvious how to do that. All right, so this is the story for this theory. It's pretty simple. You can write down other orbifold cases, some, you know, C3 mod Z5 or other more complicated orbifolds. The theories get more complicated. They have more gauge groups. The anomalous dimensions are not rational anymore. But the story about S duality turns out to be the same. There's the same kind of pattern here with these four different theories. All of that is the same. The dynamics of the theories become more complicated, but this stays the same. That's true at least for any isolated orbifold singularity. Part of the reason I say isolated is because I'm using some intuition based on the ADS dual, but if the singularity is not isolated, then I don't know what this discrete torsion means anymore. It becomes a bit more subtle. Any questions at this point? So now I'm going to go on to singularities that are not orbifolds. And I'm basically going to talk about one of them because it will be plenty complicated enough. The geometry itself is not complicated. This is just the DP1 singularity. It's described by this gauge linear sigma model here. Or if you like toric diagrams, it's described by that one. And you can partially resolve this singularity because this is let me say it a different way. You can blow this up and you get a cone over the first Del Pezzo surface. That's why it's called this. But the first Del Pezzo surface is just P2 blown up a point, and C3 mod Z3 is a cone over P2. So you might think that these singularities are related too, and they are. In other words, you can split this singularity into C3 mod Z3 and something which is ordinarily not singular, but if you put in the orientifold, it actually becomes an O3 point. So for this orientifold here, I can split this orientifold singularity into the one I just told you about, which is quite simple, and an O3 point, which is also quite simple. There's two simple parts. Okay, and that's going to be a very important tool for figuring out what's going on later on. So what gauge theories do I get from the singularity? Here's without the orientifold. This is well known. It's some four-node quiver like this. In order to construct the orientifold, I'm going to tell you one way that you could have gotten to this answer, and then I'll put in the orientifold. So there's a T-dual description because DP1 is toric, so it has a T2 vibration. And I T-dualize on that T2. and I get some configuration of D5 brains and NS5 brains. So what I have here is I have a torus. I should specify that. This is a torus, and this is R2. And on the torus, I have N D5 brains. And then they're at a point here. And stretching away from that point, I have NS5 brains going at different angles. These angles are determined by the geometry. And because they end here, their charge has to go somewhere. And I guess it's almost invisible, but this is shaded here. And that's shaded a different color. So what this means is that the NS5 brain bends over and is parallel to the D5 brain here. So what I have here is, say, an N0 brain in terms of PQ brains. Now this is an N1, and over here is an N-1 because of the NS5 brain bending over. They had to go somewhere. So from this configuration, I didn't mean to put the stars here yet. You can ignore those. That's the orient fold. From this configuration, you can read off the gauge theory. And the way that you do it is that everywhere that you have two of these NS5 brains crossing on the torus, you have two different N0 brains that are touching at a point, and you're going to get matter. But because of the NS5 brains, it's chiral matter. So you get chiral bifundamental matter, where you could choose your conventions so it goes like this. And then also, these NS5 brains have a loop of chiral matter around them. And this is going to turn out to correspond to a term in the superpotential. So based on these ingredients, all the open faces become gauge groups. These become chiral matter, and these become superpotential terms. I can read off the gauge theory. So that could recover the answer that I showed you a few slides ago. Let me tell you a few things about this description that will be useful in a second. So I give a particular placement for these NS5 brains here. Now, the angles in this direction are fixed by the geometry, but the positions here are not fixed. So I can move them side to side. Again, forget about the stars here. And there's a one or more moduli here. In this case, it's one. The counting in this case is because there's four NS5 brains, and each of them can be moved transverse to its direction. But then there's two translations in the torus that I have to remove. But then there's also a BPS condition, which is basically that the area of the N1 and the N-1 faces are the same. So there's one modulus left over. And there's a very simple physics here, which is that this is T-dual to a Wilson line for B2 on S2, where S2 is part of the link of the singularity. The DP1 singularity has a link which is S2 cross S3. That's because the geometry is topologically the same as the conifold geometry. Different complex structure, but topologically the same. All right, so we have this modulus. And I'm going to want to keep track of this modulus in a second because it will tell me about what happens when I orient the fold. OK, so now I want to put in the orientifold plane. So now I do mean the stars. So when I put in this O7 plane in the original, wrapping the DP1 in the original description, after T-dualizing, that's going to turn into an O5 plane, or actually four O5 planes, because I T-dualized twice. And these are going to be, in the usual way, they're going to be at four points on the torus. And then they stretch in these two transverse directions here. But now something different happened, which is that the modulus I told you about before is gone, because these NS5 brains are forced to pass through the O5 plane. Otherwise, you would have to have another NS5 brain that was its image, that was parallel, that had the same charge as it. But that I don't have that in this geometry. So I'm forced to put the NS5 brains on top of the O5 planes. That kills the modulus that I had. But notice it doesn't kill it completely, because I can either put them here, or I can put them half a period over. So for each of these NS5 brains, there's still two choices. But then there's a similar kind of counting to before. I have four of these NS5 brains, but then I can remove two half-period shifts that don't do anything. And then there's a different condition than before, which is that although the BBS condition is automatic, I need to have an even number of NS5 brains crossing each of these O5 planes, or else the NS5 brain charge won't be invariant under the involution. I'll have something where, you know, N1 brain is mapped to an N0 brain. So I get two possible positions for the brains. And one of them I already showed you. It's the more garden variety one. So that's this one here. And the other position is this. So maybe you'll notice, I'm sorry, this is an unfortunate choice of color. Again, these are supposed to be shaded. It's too light. But I told you before about how to read off the gauge theory, right? So for instance, you get matter here, and you get some gauge group here. I didn't tell you anything about this. And of course, there's a good reason for that, which is that this kind of thing wouldn't generically happen ordinarily. The only reason it's happening now is because there's an O5 plane there, and it's forcing it to happen. I'm going to show you this in a few minutes, but you can kind of think of this as some gauge group that actually shrunk down to zero size. So there's something strongly coupled going on right here, which I will show you in a minute. I guess the order I put the slides in, I'm going to first tell you about how to get the gauge theory here, which is more garden variety. So first of all, This leftover modulus is again t-dual to this Wilson line. And the fact that it's projected out is because this Wilson line is odd under the involution. So in the usual way, if I have an axion that's odd, I can either set it to 0 or 1/2. So I have two choices left over, right? Because if it's 1/2, 1/2 gets mapped to -1/2, but that's the same as 1/2 by shifting it by an integer. So I have two possible choices for this discrete Wilson line. But it turns out that this discrete Wilson line is actually part of the discrete torsion group. It's classified by this. I mean, this has more in it than the discrete Wilson line, but that's part of it. So what that tells you is that the NS5 brain position is part of the discrete torsion in the dual description that I started. And this group, which you can compute, has now two Z2 factors. And I can give you a very simple intuition for that, which is that I told you before that you can split the singularity into two pieces. One piece is this C3 mod Z3 orientable singularity, and one is an O3 plane. And each of those has an associated discrete torsion. So what this is just saying is that you don't lose any information when you put them together. You can still see all of that information. So that's why there's two factors here. I'm going to skim this. But the rest, I've only told you where half of the information of the discrete torsion comes from. I told you that part of it was the position of the NS5 brains. The other half of it is the charge of the O5 planes. And maybe that shouldn't be surprising, because if you remember before, the two different choices of H torsion were relating, say, SO and SP. And SO and SP, of course, correspond to O planes of different charges. So maybe you know that when an O5 plane meets an NS5 plane, its charge flips. So this is what's happening in the transverse direction. You have two NS5 brains at that O5 plane, something like this. Or if you have four, then it would flip four times. So then I can map out what the O5 charges are by just asking, here are these four different colors, are my four O5 planes. And then I'm saying in each wedge here, so each angle between two of the NS5 brains, what's the O5 charge in that wedge of this O5 plane? And so you can see something like this, where the O5 charge of the orange one flips crossing this thing. That means that this NS5 brain crosses that O5 plane. Right, it didn't have to. It could be crossing some other one. But you can read off from this diagram that it crosses this one because this sign flipped. And this sign here doesn't flip, so that means that this brain doesn't cross that O5 plane. The other information in here is the relative signs of these things. In one wedge, the relative sign of the O5 planes, of the four O5 planes. And that just turns out to specify the geometric involution. So since I'm only interested in one geometry right now, that's not going to change. All the other geometries, by the way, have non-compact O7 planes. So they have some singularity that's not isolated. So in this case, that's why I'm not considering that. And now this is slightly too much information. But you can map out, now that I've told you the extra information, you can map out all of the four choices of discrete torsion. So if you like, it's just what I showed you a second ago. Here's one and here's two. That's very easy to picture. And the other differences are just an overall flip in these signs. You can forget about the details of what the individual signs are. But these A and B are just related by an overall flip of the signs. All right, so, and then I can extend my dictionary from before about how to read off the gauge theory. This part is, I think I missed something there. this is supposed to be an SO gauge group and an SP gauge group. So this is pretty simple. In fact, you could probably work this out in your head. And this is only a little more complicated. So, based on the charges of the O5 planes, I'm either getting SO or SP gauge groups when it has some, when it sits in an open face, or if it sits in an intersection of two NS5 brains, I'm either getting symmetric or anti-symmetric tensor matters. Okay, so if I only have up to two NS5 brains intersecting on one of these O5 planes, I'm golden. I can read off the gauge group. And I can do that for 1A and 1B. So here you have the answer for these two theories. It's only slightly more complicated than the C3 mod Z3 gauge theory I told you before. And if you want to relate it to that, just think about turning on a VEV for this tensor over here. And once you put that in here, you're going to recover the other theory. Right, you turn on a VEV, this field gets eaten. And then you're left with the C3 mod Z3 gauge theory. All right, so I've generated some gauge theories, and these could be generated in other ways, probably.
Sorry, what's the flavor symmetry in these things?
Ah, good. I should have written that down. Oh, that's down here, actually. Okay, so what I have is I have SU2 cross U1, which is the flavor symmetry of the first delta SO surface, the isometry group, sorry. And then I have an extra U1 baryon. I have a baryonic U1 because I have the S2 or the S. Because I have a cycle in the horizon of ADS, I reduce some. It's because of the S2, I reduce C3 on S2 and I get a photon. So that gives me an extra baryonic symmetry. And then, of course, I have an R symmetry. So this is the symmetry group. I can now do the same kind of thing with anomaly matching. And I'm going to find that anomalies match for a difference of two in the ranks instead of three. However, I do have to have n be odd. And the reason is that there's a Witten anomaly for the SU2, and it doesn't match if n is even. And then I can go and do something more complicated, like computing the superconformal index. And it turns out that in the cases here where anomalies matched, the indices agree. And in the other case, they don't. Or they agree up to, you know, many terms, as many terms as we can compute. All right. So here's a pair of theories that's not so hard to understand. It's not, in principle, different than the orbifold theories I told you about before. Let me try to map out where these sit in discrete torsion space. The way I'm going to do that, again, is by splitting the singularity into two pieces and then just identifying the discrete torsion of the two pieces with the generators of the discrete torsion group. So all I have to do is I do this in the gauge theory, which corresponds to turning on some baryonic BEV. And then I'm going to find that it's going to split into two different gauge theories. And then I just look at what I know about the discrete torsion of those gauge theories. It's going to be the C3 mod Z3 theory and the n equals 4 theory. So it's straightforward. And what I find is that in terms of the generators for C3 mod Z3 and for the O3 plane, these 1A and 1B occupy the middle two rows of possible discrete versions. And these dots are colored so that the same colored dots are related to each other by SL2Z. So for instance, these two guys here are S-dual to each other. And that's, in fact, the S-duality that I just told you I checked. That's the one for which I checked the superconformal index, or I notionally did. But then if I factor in also the other generator of SL2Z, then instead of just having a pair, I'm going to have this whole orbit of six different choices here. Where again, these are paired up in twos, where these are only related by shifting the axion. So the gauge theories are the same. OK, so this is great. But then I have theories here which are S dual to question mark, because I haven't given you a theory with that discrete torsion yet. So this is the problem. Where are those theories? The answer, as I've been setting up, is that those theories come from the case where I have four NS5 grains crossing on the O5 plane. So the challenge is to understand that. All right, now as I alluded to before, I'm going to tell you why that's a hard problem. So think about the case without an orientifold and allow these things not to cross at exactly a point. So I let them deform away a little bit. So here they're moved to one side, and you see there's a face here. So now let me move them. I'm going to move them back and forth a little bit. So you see what happens? The face that I have here first goes to zero size and then grows another face. In fact, this is exactly cyber duality. You can check, this is just cyber duality. But of course, if I want to have an involution, I'm forced to be there. And when I'm sitting here, that gauge group that I had before is now has zero area, which means the gauge coupling is infinite. So this is very strongly coupled. It's like halfway through a cyber duality. So that's bad. I'm not just going to be able to use perturbative techniques and read off the answer. But I wouldn't be going on about this at such length if I didn't have a way of getting the answer. And the trick that I'm going to use is called deep confinement. This is a trick that just originated in n equals 1 field theory literature. As far as I know, it's never been used for string theory before. And it's just based on this observation. You take an SP gauge theory with the right number of vectors, and it S-confines. So all you have left over is an antisymmetric tensor of the flavor group and a superpotential. But the superpotential is bad. The superpotential means that, for instance, if I wanted to take some antisymmetric tensor and replace it with some S-confining gauge theory, this would be breaking some of my flavor symmetries. So it's nice to find a way to avoid having a superpotential left over. And that's straightforward to do. What we do is basically add some extra fields over here. All of these, this is designed so that all of these fields get masses when it S confines. But not only do they get masses, the F term conditions for this Q and this T will set enough elements of the Pfaffian to zero that the Pfaffian itself vanishes, and so the superpotential is gone. So what now happens now is that this confines, I have an antisymmetric tensor, I have no superpotential, and I have left over a flavor symmetry under which nothing is charged. So this is what I call a trivial flavor symmetry, which means from the infrared perspective, it's not there. So from the infrared perspective, I've introduced a fictitious flavor symmetry in order to replace this antisymmetric tensor with a gauge group. This is the first in a series of examples where, even though I'm only interested for S-duality in the fixed line, you can do all kinds of crazy stuff to the UV theory while still keeping the same same fixed point. And the other thing to note about this is that the F, the number of flavors that I introduced here, is almost arbitrary. However, it has to have the same parity as N just because this group is only defined in that case. So it's arbitrary up to its parity, which is fixed. Otherwise, the value of F does not affect the infrared physics. All right, so now what I want to do is I want to take this deconfinement, this thing here, and I want to realize it in the NS5-brain, D5-brain system that I was telling you about. And here's the heuristic idea, which is I take an antisymmetric tensor, which is two NS5-brains crossing on an O5 plane, and now I blow up a face around this O5 plane. And that face is going to have an FP gauge group, and here's some matter here, so that's looking hopeful. But there's one immediate problem here, which is that when I blow up the face, I can't. Now, this is bad too. That's not supposed to be blue. This is a different color. It's supposed to be purple. The point is that I couldn't, you know, this couldn't be blue because if my NS5 brain goes through like this, it's not invariant under the involution. In other words, these two brains here are some extra other brains that I had to create to do this. OK, so now there's some non-trivial thought process that goes in. How can I create some extra brains without messing everything up? And here's a picture, which is unnecessarily complicated. So try to ignore all of the things in parentheses, because I meant to take them out. I didn't have time to. The picture is basically, this is the same as I showed you before. But now on top of this, imagine that you have kind of a bubble stretching out in another direction. And in this bubble, these blue and red brains here that seem to end, they actually end on top of the bubble. So they didn't go away, which they couldn't. And these new brains, which I introduced, are actually the walls of the bubble. So in other words, I take, another way of thinking about it is I take these brains here, I twist them up a little bit, and now I kind of separate out the stack of D5 brains. So I create a gap in the middle. And when I do this, I want to add some extra D5 brains along the top of the bubble as well, as well as this NS5 brain. And the reason is very simple, because I want to reproduce the case where I don't get a superpotential. Now, there's all kinds of things to worry about here. Chiefly among them is the fact that this is not supersymmetric. These brains are arbitrarily curved. This is not a BPS configuration. There is a heuristic argument that this should still give you the right answer, but it's very heuristic. And the argument is just that suppose that I'm going to allow myself to deform string theory by some external source and force this thing to be BPS. But now that's not physical. So I have to ask, what happens when I take that deformation away? And The point is that if what I end up with has all the right flavor symmetries, there's only so many things that can happen to the infrared physics. Because it depends on what operators I have in the infrared that could be turned on that respect the flavor symmetries that I have. So for instance, I'm by hand preserving supersymmetry, I can only turn on a supersymmetric operator. If you work it through, you can determine that if I preserve the R symmetry in the UV, I can only turn on a marginal operator in the IR. But if there's, say, no exactly marginal operators around, then even that is irrelevant. So that would mean I do nothing to the infrared physics. So this is a very hand-wavy argument, but at least it has the benefit of explaining something which will turn out to work. At least this will give all the right consistent answers. And in fact, this configuration of brains here has no exactly marginal operators until I put it into the torus. Of course, at the end it has to because I'm studying S duality. But before that, it has no exactly marginal operators. All right, so now I'm going to take this module that I've developed for so far just doing something that I already knew was true in field theory, which is replacing an anisometric tensor with a SP gauge group and preserving the infrared physics. But now I want to take this quadruple crossing of brains, and now I'm going to apply the same kind of deconfinement to a pair of them while leaving the other pair untouched. And the idea is that if I pick a neighboring pair, all of the way that I'm deforming the brains and everything doesn't affect these other brains. It's all happening around. The only places where these brains intersect those brains are right here on the torus. It doesn't see any of the other weird stuff that I did. So at least this gives me a prescription for reading off the gauge theory. And now I can look at this theory and see if it has the right properties. So this is what it is. It's kind of ugly, but that's what it is. So I have a gauge group. I have some tensor matter. I have this flavor symmetry that I had to put in. And if I did it right, it should be true, like before, that this flavor symmetry is actually trivial. So that means in the infrared, nothing is charged under that symmetry. I'm running out of time, so let's see. Let me tell you a little bit about this, and then I will come to that. So let me show you quickly that this is true, that this SUF is, in fact, trivial. And the way that I do it is by more deconfinement. So this is the picture of the theory I'm working with in terms of the NS5 brains and D5 brains. Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to say, well, I have another pair that I can deconfine here. So let me deconfine them. So that's all I did in this picture, although the animation is a little bit jerky. So now I've just put this extra bubble in here. Even in the field theory, it's obvious that this is the same. And now let me just move the bubbles past each other. And what that really means is cyber-dualize this gauge group here. So all of these steps are well-defined in the field theory. And this is what I end up with after that. But now I have another situation where this bubble can just be allowed to collapse. So I go to that. OK, so what I've told you is that this is in the same universality class as that. But notice that because the flavors that I had before were associated with this point here, everything that's charged under that SUF, at the point when this reconfines, there's nothing left. So now the SUF is manifestly trivial. On the other hand, I had to introduce another SUG, if you will. And that thing is not manifestly trivial. But because I introduced it along the way, it's obvious that it is. So just by playing off with these deconfinement and cyber dualities, I can show that the SUF is trivial. I can also see that the value of f has no possible effect, except that the parity matters. Again, for the same reason that it mattered in Feynman. All right, there's all sorts of other checks I can do to convince myself that this description of the quadruple crossing is the right one, which I don't have time to go through. But now I just want to quickly show you the result of this, so the result for S duality. All right, so there's another way to deconfine them, which I won't say anything about because it's closely analogous. It just, there's a slightly different way that these frames cross, okay? So now, by just sticking this into the torus, which essentially means gauging some flavor symmetries, turning on some superpotential deformations, I get the full theory that I'm interested in. And again, this theory is written in terms of this deconfined stuff. But because what I'm now going to do is compute an index, all of this crap about SUF and everything is not going to matter. It won't contribute to the index because it's trivial. So this is the two different cases. In one case, I have both the parity of F to specify and also the parity of M can be one or the other. In the other case, I have some SP gauge group. So that's fixing the parity of M, but I still have the parity of F to play with. So in one case, I have four different choices, and in the other case, I have two. All right, so now I can do the partial resolution thing to figure out what discrete torsion these theories have. And this is the result that I get. So everything is exactly is completely specified by that, except the relative position of these two theories. There's an ambiguity in that procedure because of the issue with the O3 plus and the O3 plus tilde and telling which is which. And it's not so easy to tell the relative tilde between the C3 and the C3 Monte. Anyway, there's an ambiguity here, which I've just fixed because I know the answer, but will be checked when we see the superconformal index. And now you can take this set of theories, and you can go and compute the index for each of these theories, at least for certain values of n. And what you're going to find is that when you expect an S duality, they do match. And they match to, you know, as many terms as you can compute, which in some cases is a lot. You know, these are results that will fill a whole page in small font. And when you don't expect an S duality, you'll find that not only do the indices not match, they almost immediately don't match. And this is mainly because I'm looking at low n, and the reason they don't match is baryons. But at low n, the baryons are right there at the bottom of the index. If I went to higher n, they would be higher. All right, so that's the conclusion about S duality. So let me end there.
Do you have conclusions?
I didn't write them up. That was the other part of not having finished writing up my slides. I can tell you both of these examples that I told you about, the Orbifold example and the DP1 example, there are lots of other examples like these. So I can study all kinds of other toric singularities, which is partly what we're doing right now. Studying other Orbifolds is even easier. So there's a huge class of S dualities here. It's an enormous, and actually in a lot of non-toric examples, when you look at, say, the DP2 singularity, the next level complexity, now it's true that all of the cusps have this weird form with the deconfinement and all of that stuff going on. So if you didn't know about that, you wouldn't even be able to construct any theory at all. So it's essential for understanding the physics of E3 brains at these singularities. But there's other things that we're trying to understand. For instance, we'd like to understand if these S dualities can be connected to class S dualities or other S dualities that we know about already. One of the things that we're trying to do for that is to study cases where these become theories with extended supersymmetry. Unfortunately, that means you have to go to non-isolated singularities. That's something I haven't figured out yet. So for instance, you have C2 mod Zn times C. It's a non-isolated singularity, but it gives you n equals 2.
What is special or interesting about this particular class of examples involving the Delpezzo surfaces? Just the simplest constructions?
Yeah, I mean, the Delpezzo surfaces are the simplest, in some sense, the simplest singularities of their types. But I don't think there's anything else particularly special about the Delpezzo surfaces. There's zillions of other toric examples. Of course, we have not worked them all out. We know a procedure for working them out.
What's the dimension of the space of marginal deformations?
In this case, it's always 1. So that's very special because the involution happened to project out all these other marginal deformations that you had. So like the anise fibrins and all that stuff happened to be removed. And so you only have top. There's other involutions that don't do that. What's special about this involution is that actually not only is the space toric, but the quotient space is toric. So in that case, this is always what happens for those involutions. So that's another thing we don't know much about, is other involutions.
I mean, it would be nice to find examples with more complicated geometry.
Yeah.
That's right. Any other questions? Take that again.